Right, the Cabinet today has approved the National Civil Defence Emergency Management Plan order that's been signed by the Governor-General. It's gone in Rick Barker's name. This is the first such plan produced pursuant to the 2002 Civil Defence and Emergency Management Act. Now, the proposed plan went out for public consultation in August, and it's required by statute to be approved by the end of this month. So that's all on track. It comes into force on the 1st of July next year. We've also approved the New Zealand Influenza Pandemic Action Plan. This is version 14 from officials, and it will be continuing to be updated with best practice and more information. Pete Hodgson will be releasing it within the next couple of days, and it's obviously something I want to take to APEC with me because avian flu is one of the issues on the agenda for discussion there. But coming up in the House this week, obviously this week and first couple of days of next week are preoccupied with the address and reply debate, with the formal moving and seconding tomorrow afternoon. Dr. Cullen will also be seeking to have a couple of bills introduced and given first readings. That's one of the tax bills and the subordinate legislation confirmation and validation bill as well, and he'll also be wanting to put the government notice of motion on the House sitting calendar. Otherwise, coming up this week, Trevor Mallard will have an announcement out yesterday with respect to New Zealand joining the International Convention on the Doping in Sport issue. It'll go through the normal select committee examination process. There will be a release of the annual report on the school sector by the Minister of Education. We'll be starting to release the various briefing papers to incoming ministers in the course of this week. There'll be update announcements on the meningococcal meningitis vaccination program from the Minister of Health. Announcement around new funding for innovation in schools from Steve Mahari. Be an update later in the week about investment in film industry in New Zealand from Trevor Mallard. And come Thursday, I understand we're expecting the Transport Accident Investigation Commission report into the ferry steering mishaps in the Marlborough Sounds and Wellington Harbour. I'm away late tomorrow for the whirlwind visit to Dublin and to Pusan, reaching Ireland on Wednesday for a series of meetings that day with the President, Prime Minister, Finance Minister, the National Competitiveness Council, and meeting with some of the Kiwi constituency, rehearsing for the presentation to the IRB, and then that occurs on the Thursday morning at Dublin time, Thursday night New Zealand time. Then it's through to APEC. The statement on that was put out last week. But just to summarise, obviously the APEC meeting is very well timed with respect to the WTO ministerial meeting in Hong Kong. Progress towards that has clearly stumbled somewhat of late. The informal meetings have not been as successful as one would have wished in sorting issues out. So with APEC representing 60% of the global economy, clearly a statement out of the APEC leaders will carry some weight, one hopes, and I think there will be a lot of time in our retreat sessions spent on that. It's also the time for APEC to be reviewing the progress towards the Bogle goals. What's called the midterm stocktake has been done, and although it would seem unduly optimistic to say that people will actually realise all the commitments they made by 2010, nonetheless, it's fair to say that the APEC economies have opened up to trade a great deal since the Bogle goals in 1994 and have made significantly greater progress at opening up than other regions of the world. As I said, there'll be discussion about the avian flu pandemic, recognising that if there were to be an outbreak of human-to-human transmission, it would most probably emerge from within the APEC region. APEC has tended to broaden its agenda into areas like this, recognising the huge impact on economies, to say nothing of the human impact of something like avian flu breaking out. So it will be handy to have the New Zealand plan. And last APEC in Chile, I led a discussion on health issues, on communicable diseases, and on the public health infrastructure and arrangements that needed to be made to deal with epidemics properly. Counter-terrorism is always on the APEC agenda as well, and it's likely there will also be some discussion about oil and fuel security issues. I will be home on Sunday, but I'm also issuing a statement today about the CHOGM, which starts in Malta on Friday of next week. I will get there the day before and address the Commonwealth Business Forum, which is occurring prior to the leaders' meeting. I'm on a panel on the topic of expanded international trade and investment with the presidents of Nigeria and Kenya, the Sultan of Brunei. And then the summit itself will run from the Friday through the Sunday. The Commonwealth for us is a window on the world of regions that we otherwise don't have very active links with. I think particularly of the Caribbean, much of South Asia, we're only represented in India, the Indian Ocean countries, and then a good deal of West, East and Southern Africa we generally have contact with through the Commonwealth connections. The Leaders Summit has a broad agenda. Trade, again, it's run up to the WTO round, and the Commonwealth has the perspectives of many of the very small developing countries. Governance, the Commonwealth for many years now has been a force for democracy, human rights, better governance. Terrorism, again, will be on the agenda. Development issues, those would be the major themes around the retreat. In the area of terrorism, the Commonwealth is looking at what role it might play in promoting religious tolerance, and our government has been giving support to regional interfaith dialogue in the Asia-Pacific area. And so I think it will be a useful discussion for us to contribute to. Following the last CHOGM, there were changes made to the agenda. I wasn't the only leader present who felt that the meetings were perhaps a little long and discursive, so it has been tightened up. And there will be a more formal foreign ministers meeting prior to the leaders' meeting where some of the more detailed issues can be dealt with. And there's more time provided in this CHOGM for retreat sessions, which the leaders find of most value, rather than rather formal and formulaic executive sessions. I'm going to go from CHOGM for 2 days in Brussels with a range of calls on the Commission. European Commission. I haven't been for 2.5 years. The Commission has changed since then. So I'll be meeting with the President, José Manuel Barroso, and a number of the commissioners covering external relations, trade, agriculture, EU enlargement. Again, looking to the Doha round, quite a well-timed call. I'll also be meeting with the NATO Secretary General, Belgian Prime Minister, members of the European Parliament too. So, yeah, any questions?
Well, Minister, what difference do you believe you can make to the IRB, given that you're a patron of rugby league here?
I'll have to observe the union did better than the league at the weekend. I think going into this World Cup bid, we have to recognise that New Zealand is a very small country up against much larger countries. Particularly Japan, many times our size and with huge GDP and private sector resources to put on the table for sponsorship around a cup bid. Then there's also South Africa, which hosted 10 years ago, also a great rugby nation. I understand Nelson Mandela will be fronting for the South African bid. South Africa also has many times our size. So in the rugby union's view, and the government agrees with this, was always critical in mounting this bid that it was seen to come from New Zealand Incorporated, and that the government was right there alongside and behind the rugby union financially, morally and in every other way. And to demonstrate that, I agreed that I would go to Dublin to reinforce the bid.
What will you be telling them?
I will be putting the New Zealand case for hosting the Cup. And the case will rest on New Zealand being the world's most passionate rugby nation. It is our major men's sport. Nowhere else in the world does it have the following and the level of skill that it has in New Zealand. I will be pointing out that small countries with this kind of passion for a game should every so often get the opportunity to host. I'll be pointing out that we clearly have the capacity to do it, that the New Zealand government is standing with the rugby union to ensure that the bid is viable, can be afforded. I'll be pointing to the fact that the Lions Tour was a tremendous success and in a sense a trial run for the sort of systems that you have to run to host a major tournament successfully. So it's really a case of working with the other rugby union presenters to put the very best light that we can on the Kiwi case, recognising that we're a small country and we're up against some pretty big players.
Would the government be prepared to underwrite it?
Well, we are in effect underwriting quite substantially with the support announced last year for the bid.
Do you think the IRB will look at those sentimental issues rather than commercial realities of Japan?
It's not for me to judge what criteria the IRB will use. What we know is that the assessment of the bids, of the three bids, judged New Zealand's as, I think, the safest bid in terms of they know a tournament will work here, they know exactly what to expect. The IRB executive was out here for the Lions Tour. They were pretty impressed with what they saw and with the level of commitment from the rugby union and from the New Zealand government. So we just have to put this case as strongly as we can. Yes, I do. I think that this is a very credible bid. As I say, it's up against other credible bids. But at some point, those who make credible bids have to have a chance of being seriously considered. Now, obviously, one goes in the hope that that will be this time for us.
Prime Minister, a different type of ball, perhaps. Do you agree with the American Ambassador's assessment that the ball lies in New Zealand's court in terms of improving relations with Washington?
No, I think the last ambassador, before he went, made a speech calling for a dialogue, and of course we responded, we're always happy to have a dialogue. So the ball's in everybody's court, I guess. Having said that, I'm not one who takes a bleak view of the relationship. The American relationship is very important to us. It's a huge trade relationship, investment relationship, tourism relationship, education and science relationship. It's actually quite a significant defence relationship in some critical theatres like Afghanistan and the Gulf. So overall, it's a very, very good relationship, and my endeavours have always been aimed at getting the breadth and depth of the relationship appreciated rather than having an undue focus on one issue where we don't see eye to eye. Letting that issue dominate would be as silly as letting the fact that we don't agree with Japan and its whaling policy dominate our relationship with Japan.
But are you willing to have a full review of the relationship the way that
Charles Well, look, that's for the United States if it wants to review the way it operates vis-a-vis New Zealand. From our point of view, New Zealand has always turned the other cheek and said, let's get on with life. There's 99.9% of things we work very happily on, and we'll keep doing that.
So will it be a one-way review, not a joint review?
Well, it was never suggested that there be a joint review. What appeared to be suggested was there might be some rethinking going on in Washington. That was the inference from Mr. Swindell's statements. As I said, we're always happy to have a dialogue, but it will have to occur within the framework of the nuclear-free legislation.
Thank you.
The Americans do seem to regard the nuclear issue as the issue. When they talk about dialogue and when they talk about the ball in our court, surely that means the nuclear policy, doesn't it? Is that
well, that's a matter for them, but what I'm telling you is that I've studied this relationship for a long time, and I know it's got tremendous breadth and tremendous depth, and I'm not prepared as Prime Minister to say you can't have a decent relationship because there's one or two things you don't agree on. If that was the case, we wouldn't have a decent relationship with anybody.
Winston Peters has said today that he's concerned about the decline in China, thousands of Chinese students, and he's going to discuss it with China. And in particular, he said that New Zealand hasn't kept to its agreement to ensure that students return home after they finish their studies. What do you think of that?
Well, I'd be really pleased if he picks up with his Chinese counterpart the Chinese student issue, because the Minister of Education, for the first two terms of our government, put a tremendous amount of effort into that relationship. Obviously, there were problems with some cowboy operators and others who let Chinese students who paid good money for courses down very, very badly. And that got New Zealand a bad name in China, to the extent where the Chinese Education Ministry warned on its website against studying here. And that had a significant impact on the numbers, which is now being felt in New Zealand educational institutions across the country. Now, Mr. Mellor put a lot of personal effort into going to China and working with Chinese officials to get that relationship back on an even keel. The numbers have not built up to what they were, and anything that Mr. Peters or any other minister can do to advance that would be very much appreciated.
One thing helped with tourism more changes in Australia and Britain, is you
not specifically, but obviously we keep an eye on what other people are doing, and if we see a need for change, we'd introduce it, but at this time it's really a watching brief.
Prime Minister, do you think an inquiry of some shape is needed into TVT?
Well, I'm not sure that it's needed. It won't be to say it won't happen. I'm sure it'd be something for TV3 to lead with night after night. Of course. Not really. I think the select committees have got to discuss that themselves. Of course, the TVNZ annual report is to be filed this week, and that goes to the Finance and Expenditure Committee, which might point in that direction if there is to be a look at TVNZ.
Doesn't TVNZ run the risk of being inquired into by two different select committees?
Well, I don't think that would make a lot of sense. I think if the Finance and Expenditure Committee takes the step to look at it, that should surely obviate the need for anyone else to do so.
What do you think is important for a focus on? Is it a dividend issue or is it a salary issue?
Well, I'd be concerned if it leads to undue politicisation of issues around Television New Zealand. These issues are not political ones. These are issues of governance and management of personnel. They're not political issues.
Are you expecting more criticism portion of the senior debt with the arrival of the union
representative? I'm sure the people have always criticised it here will be more vocal, but the special rapporteur has a broad programme. He'll be seeing ministers, he'll be seeing government officials, he'll be holding a number of meetings with Māoridom. His visit isn't just focused on that particular issue, it's looking at the wide range of issues in Māori, Crown, Māori, rest of New Zealand relationships. Not to the best of my knowledge, because he's substantially here when I'm away. Yes, I do. I think the contract should have been tighter. I think everyone appreciates that helping people relocate may well be part of the package, but I would have thought it should be tied to seeing out the term. The Minister has asked for some advice on that.
So do you anticipate the contracts in the future?
Well, I anticipate that the contracts might be better in the future, yes.
But there's nothing that could actually be done about this?
Not if it's not provided for in contract. Well, it does seem a little on the generous side, I must say, that the Minister's still getting a report on it.
Have you any update on Philip Beale's inquiry by Oliver?
No, I haven't. I understand that Mr. Ingram has been having inquiries made in Samoa, but I haven't got any update on the outcome of that. I haven't got an update on that either.
Just on the CHOCM meeting, you mentioned that tourism will be coming up there and will be discussed. There was the Al Qaeda attack or criticism of the Queen. Does that put common countries at more risk, do you think?
I think the security around the Queen is always very, very high. And in a sense, going to a meeting where the Queen is at, you know that there is going to be very good security. One of the patterns we're seeing with attacks now is that obviously an international meeting can be a target, but more for somewhere else. So with the UK hosting the G8 summit, there was an attack in London, not on the G8 itself. So certainly around the time of the CHOCM would be a time for people to be vigilant, not only in Malta.
What about in the UK, Kiwis in the UK or elsewhere? I mean, New Zealand is overseas often, it's British High Commissions that are chairing to
There's so many parts of the world now where the advice to Kiwis is that you're travelling against a background of there being a threat level of significant proportions. I mean, a threat level of medium says that an attack is entirely possible and could occur. It doesn't say there's a high likelihood of it, but it says it's possible and could occur. So I certainly urge people to look very carefully at the threat warnings, because there are a lot of places in the world which were safe for people to travel freely in when people of my age did their OE, but that is no longer the case.
When will a successor for Zilbi?
We would expect to be making announcements about that in the early months of next year. Because Dame Sylvia's term was extended out to August. It would have otherwise finished in April, but that was too close for the general electoral cycle. So the thinking is starting now on the pool of names. Somebody needs to be approached, agree to do it, and then a period of notice as they disengage from other activities to go into this particular position. So I would have thought early months of next year, by which I don't mean January and I probably don't mean February either. It could be as late as April. Nobody has been approached. No, I really can't update on that. I haven't talked about it with her for quite some time. Of course, a member has a right to advance a bill, but I think she would be reluctant to see that bill go down, and unless you know you've got a clear majority for it, that's always a risk. Well, she would have my support for the bill, but that's not the issue. The issue is, would the bill pass, and does it do more harm than good to advance a bill which in the end is not going to get a first reading. It's a conscience issue. It's a conscience issue, and so you know, I know it would not get the support of the whole caucus. It's a plan that's been developed, as I understand it, around this particular pandemic of the avian flu, and it has been being revised around a number of scenarios for several months now. The officials were quite active on it during the period of the election campaign and then the negotiation period. So when Pete Hodgson releases it this week, he will say, this is version 14, and there will be updatings. It's not the final word on it, but it's as good as you can do at this time. It's seen as very closely aligned to World Health Organization recommendations, and it will represent best practice for any plan anywhere in the world. Well, as I recall, there's a kind of five-stage plan here, which says, first plan, keep it out. If it arrives, how do you contain? So it goes through a series of stages, a series of scenarios. That would appear likely, yes. It's just a question of what the timing of that would be.